Welcome to another edition of the Litigation Psychology Podcast, brought to you by Courtroom Sciences. Dr. Bill Kanowski here. I got a great guest today, Christy Harrington from First Court. She listens to the podcast. She has a very unique job. Her background is fascinating. And she's worked on a number of MedMal issues from a number of different levels. And we're doing this MedMal series for the first quarter of 2024. Christy, how are you?
Good morning. So wonderful to be here. I do listen to the podcast and excited that I was honored that you selected me to be part of this series.
Yeah, well, this is, I follow you on LinkedIn and I see a lot of your posts and it's, again, fascinating. So thank you so much for being on the show. Tell us about your background, and if you want me to refer to you as Your Honor, I can call you Your Honor. I could call you Christy. What's your preference?
I love Christy. It was one of the transitions from the bench is I had actually forgotten my first name, and everybody calls you Judge or Your Honor, and of course my son calls me Mom. So took me a while to relearn my name. So feel free, please call me Christy.
It's like the Seinfeld episode where the maestro, right? The maestro. Yeah. So I just call you the Judge, right?
You can. Yeah. Okay. So my background, had that decision between law school and medical school, and decided I wasn't smart enough to go to medical school, and then went to law school, and grew up in South Carolina and had family back in Tulsa. And so we decided that would put me in a great spot to learn something different, be in a different area. And Oklahoma has a limited license to practice law. So my first year, I started out at the prosecutor's office, and then my supervising attorney let me start trying cases, and that was all it took to be in the courtroom. And so since my first year, have been in the courtroom in a variety of capacities. I moved back home after had my son, moved back to Charleston, and was in the prosecutor's office and decided to run for circuit judge in 2007. And was elected to our circuit bench. And so that's a general jurisdiction, civil and criminal. So I had a huge learning curve on the civil bench, and really, really just fell in love with the litigation side and the difference between criminal and civil litigation.
Now, let me stop you right there. A couple comments. First off, and you knew I was going to do this. I couldn't wait. We're not even 5 minutes in this. You refer to South Carolina as the other Carolina or Little Carolina.
Yeah. Okay. North Carolina.
Number two, for this podcast, you know what shirt I'm wearing? I'd rather be in Chapel Hill.
Oh, no.
Carolina blue shirt. So I had to just throw that out there. So sorry to interrupt, but I wasn't going to let that pass. But I have a question for you right now. Being on the bench, the emotion, like there's got to be an emotional difference on a criminal versus civil case, right?
I think the simple answer is yes, but you've seen tragedies on both sides.
Yeah.
One of the early cases that I had on the bench that just, I was digging my fingernails into my skin so that I wouldn't cry. Family was killed by a drunk driver, and just the courtroom was packed, and just everybody was talking about how wonderful the young lady was that was killed. And so that was the emotional impact. But I remember, I think there's a lot of response to, well, it's just money on the civil side. Well, depending on who you are, that just money, that's emotional. And we as a society tie a lot of value and importance to money. And so when somebody is suing you because you have done something wrong and that's your business, people get emotional. Sure. in the courtroom, when I was handling criminal cases, victims of property crime were angrier than victims when their family came in. I mean, they just really got,
incredible.
they get so tied up, you know? And so even in family court, we hear, you know, people are arguing over a rug or a lamp more so than the children. So, you know, I think it's where we place value and what that particular person places value on.
Yeah. So talk to us about kind of what your role is right now. And I know you do a number of things, but again, with this background, I find it very fascinating.
Yeah. So right now, what's occupying most of my time is I am a litigation consultant with First Court. I still have my own mediation and arbitration practice. But again, I found that I am drawn to the courtroom and really love that aspect. And I feel that I do bring a unique perspective. I've taught trial advocacy at the college level and at the law school in Charleston for several years, was the director of advocacy there for a number of years. Really, so what my role is now is our client will call, they'll have a pending case, they want to either focus it for a particular issue, get evaluation of the case, really maybe think about how that attorney could do a better presentation. And so we have a variety of services, probably very much like you offer, to where we can do a focus group, we can mock trial in person or online, or I can come to the courtroom and analyze the jury, analyze how the jury is responding to the particular attorney.
Now, regarding alternative dispute resolution, you know, mediations, we know that, you know, and there's a lot of talk about, you know, crazy verdicts and stuff like that. I mean, statistically, very rare. And so many of these, I mean, I said two cases settled this week that we're going to trial. Well, no, you're not going to trial. And so I want to focus particularly in the medical side of things on kind of what your experience has been, because I think it's really important for our audience, because we have many MedMal defense attorneys that listen to this podcast. We have many claims specialists that work for either hospital systems or insurance companies that listen to this. So I certainly want to get your thoughts on that. So let's start with the in your experience, right? What are kind of some of the things that you see on the MedMal side of things, particularly from the defense, that kind of makes you cringe? Like, not like this is not the way to do things. Because what I have seen is so many of these, and I'm glad that you brought up case assessment. And I know that we both do that. It's really, really important. And what I have seen, and particularly I think it's one of the main sources of these crazy verdicts, is that the case is never really truly assessed accurately in the beginning. And then by the time you get to a mediation or some form of negotiation, the plaintiffs count, they've done their homework. They know what the case is worth. They know their strengths and weaknesses, and the defense oftentimes does not. And they miss an opportunity to really resolve the case, because then your adversary is like, oh, wait a second, I've done all my homework. Now I know they haven't. Why in the world am I going to settle this case? And then it either goes to trial with a terrible verdict, or it does settle on the courthouse steps for a much larger amount. So I'd love to hear kind of your experiences for what you've seen in kind of that process in the medical malpractice industry.
Yeah, all those things, Bill. So, you know, what I find, and as I was thinking about some of the important cases at mediation or the ones that I presided over, doctors are not your worst defendants, right? All of us go to a doctor, all of us need, have some, you know, I've had a family doctor for years and he just retired. And I, you know, I felt like that was a loss of my best friend. Right. So doctors are not their worst clients.
They're not truck drivers. They're not truck drivers, Christy. They're not truck drivers.
love the truck drivers. They bring me all
truck.
My good
I love
stuff,
the truck
right?
Yeah.
But you got a savvy person. I had to go to my local orthopedic, and so he was talking about he got a speeding ticket and he went to court, and I thought, why didn't you call a lawyer? I come to you when my knee hurts. Why wouldn't you call a lawyer? And they think, right or wrong, that they know they can handle it. And I think that's where a challenge for counsel comes in, is you've got an intelligent person who wants to fix it, and it seems very black and white. Yeah. I didn't do this. They're saying I did it. I'm going to fight it tooth and nail to the end. And it's kind of back to that reputation and that emotion tied to it. Not only are you saying I did something wrong, but this is my livelihood. And if I've got something, you know, if my patient last week says I did something wrong, that's going to affect me moving forward. So I think back, and you're going to love this, witness preparation, right? You've got to prepare your client, the doctor, for what's going to happen. And just because the plaintiff's counsel says they, you know, they killed the client or they made this mistake, they've got to be prepared to hear those things and to respond in a productive manner.
Which is like, welcome to my world. Jeez. I mean, it's such a narcissistic injury. It's like someone calling you up, like, hey, Christy, you're a bad mom. I'd be like, what? If you told my wife that, she'd slice your throat, right? And that's essentially what's happening here, is you have a plaintiff attorney and a plaintiff saying, you're a bad physician, or you're a bad nurse, or, this is where they go a lot lately, is this hospital system is putting profits over care. I mean, they just only care about money. It's a conveyor belt of just, it's a business relationship, and they go after the entity as well. And yeah, you're going to get people immediately getting defensive, going into fight or flight. And they're very close-minded, right? And they don't want to settle anything, right? But then I've had the opposite too, Christy, where you get physicians that come in and they haven't done anything wrong. So they're the opposite. So you got the fighter, right? Then you got the one that's like, I just want this freaking headache out of my, I fine. Where's settle the case? And they're looking at the claims person like, can you just settle this? And they're the opposite. They don't want to fight. So based on your experience, particularly as you approach, I want to focus on mediation here. What is the ideal mindset of both defense counsel and the client as you enter the mediation to get the most favorable and realistic and reasonable outcome?
So I encourage pre-mediation conferences. So we can do it together as the mediator. We can have a phone call with counsel. I like to do it individually, plaintiff's counsel, defense counsel, and really start getting them to think about challenging the problem, that this isn't against the doctor. This isn't a win for the plaintiff. We've got a case, and let's address it as a problem, so that we're attacking the problem, and that can take that focus off the doctor, and get that spotlight off of him. And I do think that helps when we're looking at, you know, we're not attacking the doctor. We're not attacking the plaintiff for bringing this frivolous lawsuit. We're attacking this issue. And that does seem to take the focus off. You've got to have a good ground game before, meaning you've got to lay out the ground rules before you even get into the mediation, have that pre-mediation or that mediation kind of opening session where everybody has this opportunity to talk about what's happening within a very safe space with certain rules.
Now, I try to be very fair on this podcast. And yes, plaintiff attorneys listen to this podcast. And welcome plaintiff attorneys. I'm more than happy to have you. I listen to their podcast. In fact, I listened to a bunch this week. They're very well done. They're very, very well done. And they're very professional. So since you've seen kind of things from both sides, both as a judge and as a mediator and an arbitrator, let's give you the same question. Kind of where do you see plaintiffs and plaintiffs' counsel maybe come in with unreal expectations or overplaying their hand, which kind of bogs down the process? What's the best kind of mindset from the plaintiff's side?
Plaintiff's counsel cannot just rest on the injury. They've got to have that causation piece. They've got to say that they need to be able to link the two up. And I, and this goes in personal injury case, just overall, but in medical malpractice specifically, what was the injury and what did this doctor do that deviated from that standard of care? And I think there's just a lot of reliance on my plaintiff is now unable to have children because of this surgery, or has suffered whatever undue injury because of the doctor, without necessarily acknowledging what that doctor did. Yeah. Also acknowledging perhaps that the plaintiff did not follow doctor's orders, and yeah, acknowledging that the plaintiff came to the doctor in bad health, diabetes, overweight, a litany of comorbidities. And doctors, as much as doctors think that they are God and can cure everyone, they just can't. And really setting that expectation up with the family or the plaintiff of, just because this happened doesn't mean the doctor or the hospital is liable.
Yeah, this is all great stuff. Now, what's been your experience? Again, particularly, I'm going to kind of focus on mediation. You can talk about trial too, but this is a lot of cases go to mediation. When you have the medical malpractice situation of multiple defendants, this is where things can get really shitty. And you have, maybe three doctors and the hospital system that owns the nurses, and maybe they're not all on the same page. Tell me about your experiences with that, because I think that's where, because obviously, if you have finger pointing on the defense side, this makes life very easy for plaintiff's counsel. And sometimes I think it's very avoidable. At times, at other times, not so much. What have your experiences with that?
It's been somewhat case specific, of course, is the unified front from all of the medical doctors and the hospitals, or it's been, well, we did everything we could, but it was that anesthesiologist, right? We shouldn't have used him. That was the, yeah, the one that was the bad seed in this issue. Mm-hmm. It makes it easier if they're all on the same page from a mediator's point, yeah, of view, right? Because, yeah, then I'm dealing with really two parties. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that that's the best resolution for everyone at the table. And so I think it is important, again, having whoever you are representing when you are getting ready for mediation, really helping the mediator understand who the parties are,
yeah,
and how they fit into what the plaintiff is alleging they did in this case. Mm-hmm. And if that is different from how they really fit together, letting the mediator know. I have mediated cases and arbitrated cases all over the country, but specifically, I think it depends on who you're using for a mediator. And having a mediator that understands the medical world isn't necessarily a requirement, but it does make it easier, gets you that much further, mm-hmm, ahead in your mediation. So you're not having to explain how the medical system works and the insurance and all of that, but really having a conversation with your mediator about, we are presenting a unified front. But if I can get my doctor out for this, I'd like to go ahead and do that. And so then you starting, the mediator can really help facilitate resolution.
Yeah, because that was my next question is, so from, and again, it doesn't really matter if it's plantar defense, but when choosing a mediator in a medical malpractice case, maybe what are the top qualities counsel should be looking for? One, I think you mentioned is hopefully some decent experience, you know, with cases like this. Maybe what are some other things or some things to avoid?
I think, you know, top one, have experience in the field. Again, you don't have to be only, you don't have to be a previous medical malpractice attorney to do this, but have some basic understanding of how that specialty works. Have somebody that is able to understand what we just talked about with the special needs of physicians in the hospitals and the plaintiff and the plaintiff family, that when they're coming, they've been injured, something bad has happened to them or their family member, and having a mediator that understands, that can be sympathetic, but not let that sympathy affect the resolution, and a mediator that's going to be super prepared and willing to put in the time. I see and hear mediators that they just give up when it doesn't resolve. I'm committed. You know, if we can't resolve it at the table, I'm going to let you know, I'm going to keep working until we get it resolved or you get to trial. Because every case has the potential to resolve before trial. And one of the things, you know, as much as I love to be in a courtroom, there's so much uncertainty and there's not finality in a courtroom. Yeah. So I use that to encourage, what is your tomorrow going to look like, doctor? What is your tomorrow going to look like, plaintiff? And talk about that.
So on this podcast, I like to talk about things that people don't like to talk about. But I think it's important. I think that's the way you learn. I think the plaintiff's bar is fantastic at this. When a plaintiff attorney loses a case, you know what they do? They go to a conference for plaintiff attorneys and they literally get on stage and they talk about where they screwed up. They ask for help. How could I have done this differently, right? Let's talk about mediation has gone bad. What kind of give me the particularly from the defense perspective, because I'm sure that you've seen it all. Like the not to do list. Like there's gotta be, like you've gotta see some things where you're just like, seriously, like come on, like you actually just said that, or you're unprepared. I mean, there's gotta be a bunch of things here where you've got to approach mediation a certain way, and I'm sure that you've seen a lot of things that you're like, wow, I cannot believe I just heard or saw that. What would be some of the no-nos for defense counsel approaching mediation?
Just don't get into a fist fight with plaintiff's counsel. I mean, that would be number one, right?
Number one, don't get into a fist fight. Okay.
Don't get into a fist fight. I've seen counsel, you know, want to come across the table and that's, you're there to attempt to resolve the case, and you should come with in good faith. And you say that tongue in cheek, but really there should, leave your animosity at the door. You can save that for the courtroom, but if you want to really work on resolving the case, you got to come in an effort and a spirit of resolution. So you know, don't use this as an opportunity to look good, that you're going to be a fighter in the courtroom with your client. The mediation is so different from arbitration and litigation. Don't be adversarial at the table. Use this opportunity to start talking and letting that plaintiff know from the defense attorney's perspective that this isn't a $100 million case if it's not a $100 million case. And maybe have, you know, in your preparation, have the presentation for the mediator of, here are similar verdicts in our jurisdiction. 50% are defense verdicts.
Yeah.
And so then that plaintiff is beginning to hear it in a non-confrontational way, in a very black and white way, that not all of these cases are going to be this big verdict that perhaps because they had seen a previous advertisement from the plaintiff's counsel, that they think that's what they're going to get. I think that's one of the largest challenges that I've had when I go into a caucus with a plaintiff. Is like, but this should be $1 million verdict. This should be these large numbers. And when you start talking about the black and white, and you know, pull up your jurisdiction's verdict list, it doesn't match up sometimes. So use that opportunity not only to educate your client, but also the plaintiff.
To what extent do you think plaintiff attorney advertising has resulted in actual plaintiff cognitive distortion on the potential of their case?
Oh, I don't have the exact percentage, but I would say, I mean, that happens all the time in mediation. When I'm talking to the plaintiff and, you know, that opening number, and a plaintiff will say, well, I want 10 million and their meds are 500,000 on a slight car wreck with little to no property damage. Yeah. It's hard to get them to a number that's realistic at that point.
Yeah, because I was wondering how a mediator handles it when one of this, and it can happen on both sides, where you have this crazy demand where you're like, seriously, right, from the plaintiff. But sometimes the defense can be completely unreasonable too with their counter, right?
And yeah, so, you know, and I think you've got to look at it, and the conversation typically is when I take that response to a 10 million and they come back with $500. That's where the tables, you know, that's where I see a lot of the flipping of tables and gnashing of teeth. You know, again, one of the things that the defense counsel needs to do is have a really good assessment on what this case is worth.
That's the issue.
And so if the case is worth $500, did you really need to call the mediator in who is billing at you know, whatever per hour? Why not have that conversation with, we've evaluated this case, here's how we've evaluated it based upon the common cases in this jurisdiction, your client's medical bills. Yes, our client, you know, caused an injury, but the injury isn't 5 million times the meds.
Yeah, and you know, some of the best mediation stories I have are when our clients have been fully armed with their jury research, particularly focus group and mock trial research, going into the mediation to show the mediator, listen, these guys are asking for $80 million. I focus group this thing twice, and I know it's between 10 and 20. Like I know I've done my homework, and that's had a very positive impact with mediators, with the negotiators. In fact, I won't even tell you what state it's in. It's a terrible, just awful, heartbreaking case. And they called in three plaintiff attorneys from three different states on their private jets. And they really thought they're hitting the scoreboard on this one. I mean, this is going to be nuclear everything, right? Nuclear holocaust. And our team has showed up for the mediation. And we had done two different jury projects and showed everything bad. We slanted it towards the plaintiff to make sure it would be the worst possible case scenario. And they presented the first round you know, to the mediator and to the plaintiff saying, listen, we've done our homework. We know what this case is worth. And the plaintiff's like, yeah, of course you did, with your biased jury sample. Of course the data showed up like that. And I'm sure you didn't show X, and you didn't show the photos of my, you know, the family members of my clients splattered all over the highway, did you? We're like, well, actually, yeah, we did, number one. And number two, we did it twice. We wanted to make sure we didn't get a false positive. We have two sets of data. And when the plaintiffs saw that, and then we actually put together some video clips of our mock jurors talking about the case, going, yeah, it's a terrible, terrible case. It's awful. But we don't think it's an $80 million case. And here's why. Yeah, we want them to have something, but it's not $80 million. And we had so that really, really helped and showed that, because again, I am a firm believer and really pushing this hard. If you're not assessing these cases accurately, like, so there's something everyone knows this. It's called the case assessment report, right? Or the whatever you want to call it. It's generally, yeah, what, generated at 90 days or 120 days, and then it gets upgraded, right? And I get the attorneys send these to me like before witness prep, right? Or before focus groups or mock trials. And it's one of the ways for me to get up to speed in the case, Christy. And there's always a section there on damages. And the question is, like, what is this case? Like, what's the settlement value? What's the potential we'd see at trial if we lost? And defense counsel fills in those numbers. And so my first question is, where'd you get that number? And they're like, I don't know. That's just kind of how I feel. And I'm going, like, how do you know it's a $5 million case? How do you know it's not a $30 million case? Or even better, how do you know it's not a $1 million case? Like, how do you know? And they really don't know. And so I think kind of circling back around to this case assessment, if you're shooting from the hip on case assessment, hitting the target, I mean, you don't have a scope. Your scope's not, like, it's really almost, I think, impossible. And then what ends up happening, and you know all this too well, is now mediation's failed, trial is imminent. And so now you do your mock trial. Now you do your focus group. And then you figure out, holy shit, it's a $45 million case. What the hell? And now to resolve this case, you're going to have to write a pretty hefty check. When, if you would have known, I tell you what, it makes clients nuts when they're in that process going, if I only would have known this case was so bad a year ago, mm-hmm. I would have wrote the check for the demand. And you see it on LinkedIn, by the way, there's two of them on LinkedIn yesterday. And you know how the plaintiff attorneys do it. Hey, hats off to them. But yeah, I don't know if you saw the one on LinkedIn yesterday from St. Louis, but it was the, yeah, we demanded, you know, $3 million. The top offer from the insurance company was 500 grand, and they went to verdict and got $10 million. If you would have known that, you would have gave them the check or something similar, right, to save $7 million or whatever it is. But I really think, and I think we're on the same page with this, that you would agree that a good defense strategy is to be proactive early in these case assessments, because if you misassess, it can have crazy, crazy ramifications, right?
Yeah, so the plaintiff and the plaintiff's counsel, when you go in to caucus with them with that low response, and they're like, they're just pulling numbers out of the air, and the plaintiff's or the defense attorney says, well, the plaintiff is just pulling numbers out of the air. Have something to show why you're basing it, not just that you think they're entitled to their meds. Why do you think that if this case goes to trial, that's what the jury's going to award?
Yeah, it's and listen, I do think there is some value to verdict research in the last 5 years for that type of case in that county. I think that's a good place to start. However, many of these cases have unique case facts that could make this, right? I mean, so it's like you can look at the data, but, you know, the past doesn't always predict the future. And because, yeah, your physicians, your nurses, their unique personalities. And, you know, not every bad baby case is the same or sponge left in, right? And so I think if you just exclusively relied on previous verdicts, I think that would be a dangerous way to go about things.
And just win and loss in the jurisdiction, right? Yeah. Like, there's only been defense verdicts in this jurisdiction. Well, maybe that's because they didn't resolve or for whatever reason. Sure. But I think, you know, it's not just one data point. We talk about this, you know, in our mocks as well, and getting ready for trial. It's not just one data point that you're looking for in jury selection or case assessments. You got to look at that particular case, that particular doctor, that particular plaintiff as a whole, and assess them that way.
Yeah. Okay. Final thought here, because I think we're going to be on the same page as this one, because this is how I spent half of my life. But particularly, again, back to mediation, and as the perspective of a mediator, the value of effective deposition testimony from defendants versus disastrous. Because I know when you have the doctor or the nurse, it's a videotaped deposition, and they're just terrible. And they're terrible. That does not help the defense's position on the medicine. Like, the medicine may seem great, but if you're a plaintiff attorney and you've just destroyed these witnesses and it's on videotape, doesn't that really, really shift the leverage in a mediation?
Yeah. So, you know, again, having a good presentation for the mediator helps the mediator get this resolved, move the needle one way or the other. You know, your mediator's not there to help the plaintiff or help the defense. It's to get that case resolved. And having as many things to talk about, good facts, bad facts, are important to, and having a mediator that understands what a deposition and trial is going to look like is really important too. So talking to your mediator in a way that mediator can effectively convey to either party, look, we had a deposition, the doctor tanked it. He is going to look horrible in front of 12 citizens in his jurisdiction. That's important for the mediator to know and to be able to articulate to opposing counsel how detrimental that could be and how that can relate to increase in dollars.
Absolutely. Totally agree. Listen, it was so fantastic to have you on the podcast. I'm gonna save my rant for last, because I want your opinion on this, because you're an SEC country. I'm an ACC country. I don't care what country you're in. They are doing everything they can to ruin college sports. This transfer portal and NIL, it's ruining athletic departments. And I got an email from the University of North Carolina saying, we're having this big fundraising drive for NIL, and please contribute because we need to be competitive. And I'm like, whoa. What does NIL stand for? Name, image, and likeness. If these players want to go do commercials for Popeye's chicken or for McDonald's or for the local, I don't give a shit. Hey, congrats. That's the whole purpose of NIL. You're asking me to pay the players. And I'm not doing it. I'm a very disgruntled Chicago Bears fan. They stink. They need to get better players. Well, guess what? The Chicago Bears did not send me an email like, hey, Bill, could you donate? We want more money to pay these players. No, because that's not how it works. And I'm sure between the Clemson people, which I'm sure you get along with well, and the South Carolina Gamecock people.
Gamecocks.
I just, isn't this thing just a, and there's some legal ramifications to this and some tax. I think this is very, very bad. I think it's going to just get worse and worse and worse. And I do think there's going to be subsequent litigation on these issues, because it's just the Wild West and there's just zero parameters, zero rules. And I mean, as a college sports fan, and particularly being an SEC country of all places, I think this is going to get worse before it gets better. What are your thoughts?
So, Bill, you promised me we wouldn't really talk sports on this podcast. You know, I'm not a huge sports fan.
However, don't you think? Listen, you're a judge, for crying out loud. Don't you think it's wrong to pay college athletes when they're getting scholarships, they're getting their free meals, and NIL is name, image, and likeness? Well, they can go make money making commercials. Don't you think paying players is wrong from a legal perspective?
I'm going to not comment on that one, Bill. I don't have enough information.
Are you objecting to foundation on this? Ugh.
I am.
Man, okay. Final question, because I'll leave the sports side. So you had this Murdoch case, right? So what? Okay, yeah, you have to comment on this. I'm not letting you off the hook on this because, and I watched the documentary. I watched some of the trial. My colleague Steve Wood, he's like a nut when it comes. Like he'll just sit there glued to the TV. Like, how did people like just handle that whole situation locally? And like, this is the gift that keeps on giving. Like, there's still more to come, right? It's insane.
It's amazing how many people and entities have been affected. And everywhere I go, people are like, tell me about the Murdoch case.
Yeah.
I think that Judge Newman handled it beautifully. I think the world of Cliff, he did a great job handling the media circus and everything that flowed from that. And it looks like Chief Justice Toll is going to go in and be the Iron Lady that she typically is and handle all of that fallout from the clerk of court and that book deal and all of that. So the juror misconduct. So I just hats off to the South Carolina judiciary for the way they handled that and continued to handle it. But I know the attorneys handling all the aspects in the case and it's truly a gift that keeps on giving. And just when you think you're done with it, there's something else that opens up.
It's wild. There'll be more documentaries, movies, interviews, whatever. It's a terrible case. But boy, it really took over the media there for a while. I think it'll probably come. You see some story pop up that something new has happened. But I know my wife and I watched the documentary and we were kind of glued to the TV, but to have that something happen in your back, in your backyard is kind of interesting. I live in Orlando and literally right down the street was the Trayvon Martin shooting, like 4 miles away from my house, media circus and stuff like that. I think fortunately in medical malpractice, and I guess we kind of wrap it up here, is you tend not to have the media circus like you do in some areas of litigation. I have seen some crazy med mal cases that actually did have some media issues, but typically that's not the case. But if it is an issue, how particularly from like the bench, how does that kind of change the dynamic in the courtroom or in mediation when you know it's going to be an issue?
Well, I think in mediation particularly, that's a factor, right? So mediation, we can keep everything confidential. Really hard to keep the courtroom closed. The burden to shut those public courthouse doors are huge. So keeping, that's something that can be leverage to use to get that final push over to resolve the case on, what is this going to look like at trial when we think there's going to be media coverage? Yeah. If it was a well-known plaintiff that was injured in a med mal, that's going to draw some attention. Yeah. Or if it's a doctor that this is not the first case, or a hospital, again, that continually they're having bad outcomes, that could be an expose or story that the media is like, we're just going to camp out and watch this trial. And your doctors don't want that. So, nor does a plaintiff want all of their medical issues, aired for the public, depending on who that is. I do think it's not, a murder case. We know likely there's going to be some media coverage just for general local interest and safety. But a med mal that we don't, you're right, we don't talk about what would this look like if the jurors were camped out or the press were camped out and watched the jurors walk in every day and all of that, because that also plays on the jury, right? Why is the media here for Dr. Smith and plaintiff Jones? they start to draw conclusions that maybe you might not want them to draw.
Yeah. So if you're a defense counsel and you end up in one of these unique situations, maybe get some help, get some consulting help, PR, right, whatever it takes. Cause that, I don't think defense attorneys in civil litigation have a lot of experience with dealing that situation. It'd be a terrible situation, and definitely very stressful for the client. Oh my gosh. Something you really, really don't want. Christy, thank you for so much being here. And by the way, the best thing that's come out of the state of South Carolina. Do I know who it is?
No.
Hootie and the Blowfish.
Hootie.
Only want to be with you. that was my college song. They were very popular in the 90s. And the number one thing that's come out of the state of South Carolina. But hey, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Please keep in touch. I love your LinkedIn post. To our audience, thank you for participating in another edition of the Litigation Psychology Podcast. We'll see you next time. Bye.